afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And Ashley's here. I'm so used to, Bob used to do that all the time. Jump in, and that way you know all the voices.
Yeah. And our sponsor this hour is Team Power, our local John Deere Kubota dealership. And if you're looking for a deal on a tractor, get up there and see them at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake. Their phone number is 226-9226. And just so you know, if you lost a tractor in the fire, I believe they're working on putting some programs together for folks that had fire loss to see if they can get additional discounts for a replacement for you. So go up and see them and see what's cooking there, or, well, maybe not cooking, but what's going on.
Yeah, we don't use the word cooking anymore.
No. And go see Team Power. And you can also get them on the web at readingtractors.com.
Exactly. And
there you go.
An unsolicited, I don't know, I don't know, like compliment or whatever. I guess it's a business boost, but he doesn't know we're doing it. So how does that work? He's not a sponsor, right? So we're giving him free advertisement. How's that? And it's Charles at Airco. I forgot to do that last week. And
Airco Air Conditioning Service.
So if you live in the Reading area and you're looking for somebody who actually will care that your heating and air isn't working, heating, of course, is not a problem these days, but air is a huge problem. Charles does a great job, and I really wanted to have his phone number with me, and I left it at home. I tried to look him up real quick here. I'll try and find his phone number, but seriously, if you're in the market for an air conditioning person and you really want somebody who pays attention and is, he was crafty too, because we had some weird fan and he's like, no problem, we'll get it fixed.
Yeah, he got in there and he climbed up in an attic that had to be 250 degrees and took the motor apart and figured out how to make it work.
Got us back in our house just in time for the fire to break out, so we could vacate that motel room on the day that everyone else needed it.
Exactly. Yeah, we were out of the house for 2 days for no AC. Yeah. It got hot.
So anyway, Charles at Airco, he's our hero. And there. Okay. That was one thing I wanted to make sure I didn't forget. And many thanks to Lynn and Karen and Ken and all the nice people who help sponsor the show in the kind of in the background. We appreciate you. A lot.
Very much.
And if you want more information on sponsorship and those kinds of things, and we'd be happy to promote your business, we'll do a better job than we just did with Charles, though. like we'll actually have the phone number. All we know is it's Charles, and he shows up when he says he will, and he fixes stuff. So, frankly, that carries a lot more weight than the phone number. You can just call me, and I'll get you the phone number. And our phone numbers are all on there. WeThePeopleRadio.us. So today, we're going to continue our discussion with the Siskiyou County Ag Commissioner and sealer, because we learned all about what sealers are. His name is Jim Smith, and he has just a ton of information, and I'm not sure most people realize how much an ag commissioner does in a county. And Siskiyou County has all sorts of different issues that would intersect with the ag commissioner. So we thought, we'll have him on. And he said, 2 hours, that's a pretty long time. Yeah, so last week we completely ran out of time. And so we're carrying them over to this week, and I guarantee you we'll run out of time again. So anyway, let's see, a little blurb about Jim. He grew up on a Tule Lake potato, grain, and hay family farm that his grandfather homesteaded following his service in World War I. Over the years, Jim earned a Bachelor of Science degree and a Master's from Cal State Chico. That was where we got derailed last time. He also has teaching credentials in the subject areas of agriculture, industrial arts, and science. So that's pretty neat work history. He's done all sorts of different things. And so maybe you want to recap for us a little bit, Jim, like what you do. We got in depth into what a sealer does last time, but maybe you could give him the elevator. How about the elevator talk about what sealers do? You have an elevator speech for your sealer credentials there?
The elevator story. Remind me what that was.
No, like an elevator speech. You know, like the thing, if somebody asks you in an elevator what you do for a living, you got to be able to tell them before they get to their floor. Sorry, yes, we all live in towns with no elevators, so we don't have elevator speeches up here because we don't have elevators.
The elevators I get on are generally at a grain elevator, you know, and you're hanging on for dear life.
Hanging on for dear life.
Ask the ag commissioner to give his elevator speech.
Yeah, I got 80 feet to talk to you, you know. That's pretty funny.
That is pretty funny.
So the agriculture commissioners in California represent all 50 California's 58 counties. There's 56 or so ag commissioner sealers in the state of California. They have a few counties that are pretty small that are combined together under one agriculture commissioner. And what they're doing is have the dual roles of promoting and protecting the state's basic food supply, agricultural trade, the environment, public health and safety, consumer confidence, and ensuring there's a fair marketplace in California. We have a lot of programs that we operate that allow us to focus on those things. For example, in California, you have one of the most stringent pesticide use and monitoring programs in the whole United States of America and possibly the world. So if a farmer or rancher or even a homeowner is using, you know, a pesticide for weed control or for killing bugs, pest bugs, then... by tracking a permit that the grower has to get prior to use. If it's a very dangerous compound, they have to call or inform the Ag Commissioner's office 24 hours prior to using that product so that the Ag Commissioner's office can verify that that product's safe to use in the environment that it's being planned for. And as such, we fill paperwork out that justifies and verifies that that product is safe for that piece of property that they're going to put it on, and they're going to use a method that is also safe and effective. And we monitor the application often, especially in cases of dangerous pesticides being used, so that there's actually an inspection done during the application. And at times we do a monitoring after the fact, because sometimes we get into a situation where there may be some resistance to a pesticide developed, and we are part of the remedy for that. We work pretty closely with University of California Farm Advisors in most cases. We're a great partner. They're a great partner in most of our agriculture endeavors. That's really to protect our environment, our consumers, protect our food supply. It's also ensure that farmers and ranchers continue to have tools to use when they're making, raising our food, which is pretty important. There aren't any voids in nature, as most people know, that raise a garden. If you're not pretty diligent at protecting what you're raising in your garden, something else will eat it instead of you. So those are challenges that have to be met in some manner. And I will say that over the years, with knowledge of pesticide use and the basic biology of pests that we have, the manner in which we deal with pests, both weeds, insects, plant pathogens or diseases, has drastically changed to provide for a more safe environment. Some of the newer pesticides are actually, you know, plant, live plant, or not live plant, but live organisms that can affect the pests and get rid of them without actually having any what you would consider a typical pesticide, like a typical hydrocarbon pesticide. So things do evolve as knowledge is learned and applied.
So you with that being said, I would imagine there's quite a bit of ongoing training that you have to go through to keep up with all this stuff.
Just the chemical stuff alone.
Just the chemicals and the use and who's using it and storing it and disposing of it. I mean, that sounds like a pretty complicated gig.
So that's
sounds
definitely
like a lot
true.
Of science.
It's a lot of science. It starts with the inspectors or the biologists or the deputy ag commissioners to do enforcement work in any of the arenas that we operate in. We have to have a license. And to get that license, you have to take tests. Currently, we have 5 licenses that have to be obtained by the inspectors in biology. And we have 3 in weights and measures. And after that, they have to take a deputy ag commissioner or a deputy sealer test, which is a written test, and an oral, which is graded by a board of our peers. It's usually CDFA, California Department of Food and Ag, and Department of Pesticide Regulation liaison officers, and an agriculture commissioner sit on that board. And they pass or fail you based upon your oral exam. In the case of I have two senior deputy ag commissioners, sealers, working for me. One of them runs most of the programs in my Yreka, California office, and the other is a senior deputy ag commissioner that runs the Tule Lake branch office. Both of them have specific duties, and they had the requirement of earning both a deputy sealer and a deputy ag commissioner's license prior to being promoted to that position. Agriculture commissioners are actually tasked with a couple more tests. They have to take
Hang tough on that one, Jim. We have to take a really quick break, and then we'll come right back. You know, it's funny. Just when you think there's a ton of regulation, you find out there's all this stuff under the surface.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
People are like, what? This is all going on?
Yeah. Well, so somebody's got to do it.
No kidding. Apparently so. So we're here with Jim Smith, the Ag Commissioner from Siskiyou County. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
In the town where I was raised, clock ticks and the cattle graze. Time passed with amazing grace back where I come from. You could lie on a river bank, paint your name on a water tank, miscount all the beers you drank back where I come from.
We're back. I tried to get you a whole new selection of music, Jim.
Yeah, I noticed that.
No shortage of good stuff from, you know, you just do a little search on music about rural America. It's like, what?
Oh, really?
Yeah, really. A lot of choices. So anyway, I didn't play Don't Mess Around with Jim again, although I really wanted to. the Jim Croce favorite. I've had in my playlist, and it's like, what am I going to play that for? And I was like, oh. Next guy named Jim, and that was you.
Well, you know, I was in. That was one of my favorite singers for a long time. So
I know I like that guy. We don't hear much from him anymore.
That's because we're here. Well, he's dead.
But I mean, he's not on the radio and stuff. You know, you don't hear his songs played much. I didn't mean from him.
Oh, you didn't mean like Bill, new stuff?
Bill, you smarty pants.
Yeah,
you have to sleep. You know.
Yeah,
you better watch
his new album. You're going to have to wait for that for a while.
Oh, what the heck gets into us? Okay, so back on point. So your deputy ag commissioners, they have to know have to know a bunch of other stuff.
They have to have licenses.
I was really tired at that point. We had to take a break just because I was so tired thinking about all the stuff they had to learn.
Yeah. So the ag commissioners are licensed to operate and do regulatory work in each area they operate in, and it gets like more licenses the further up the track you go. So the commissioners actually have taken about 16 tests and are pretty much licensed to do everything that needs to be done. But, you know, we're not the only ones that have to be trained, though, which you referred to. So the growers and their applicators or the pest control businesses that do that kind of work for hire are also required to have licenses to operate in the arenas that they operate in. For example, if they're going to spray a pesticide on a field crop, or a vegetable crop or something like that, they have to have a license from the Department of Pesticide Regulation for that category. And there's about 12 categories they can get a license to apply pesticides in. If you're going to make recommendations for the use of a pesticide to an agricultural producer, you have to have a pest control advisor license. And there's also 12 categories in that one to pass. Oftentimes, pest control business has a pest control advisor license and a qualified applicator license or certificate, which gives them the right to make recommendations and to apply those chemicals. The business has to have a license, and all the stuff that they do is tracked. Reports are filed every 7 days with the Ag Commissioner on what they've done and who they've done it for and how much they've used. And that information is also verified by the inspections that we do in the field on these applications.
Now, is that, does that apply also to these guys that go around and do residential spraying?
The residential spraying isn't monitored as closely, but we do inspections periodically on them. And they also are reporting all their use, but it's at the end of the month. So they'll give us a list of the materials they've used. And we often do, even up here where the numbers of structural pest control operators are pretty few and far between compared to, say, for example, in Redding. There's quite a few more in Redding. And, we do inspections. We monitor their safety training and information, their personal protective equipment, the processes that they do use when they're applying pesticides. The other thing that the commissioner does is answer to complaints. So if somebody has a complaint about any kind of a pesticide application, we go out and do an investigation and come up with a plan.
So I had a pest guy tell me one time that, you know, they're licensed to spray, you know, the different chemicals they use, but homeowners can actually buy over-the-counter chemicals that are stronger than what they're licensed to spray. Is that true?
No, that's absolutely false. The stuff that the homeowner can currently buy in a store is usually much lower strength than a structural pest control applicator, operator, that would be the business operator, can use. They can buy technical material and spray it on based upon the label's requirements at a stronger ratio, probably than the stuff you're going to buy in the store. That's a pretty low concentration in most of the homeowner products. Another little tidbit is that the homeowner products have been vetted for safety big times, 100X safety factors, low concentrations. And some of the materials are not allowed to be sold in consumer product divisions. So you don't have access to the same products that a professional might have access to.
Well, I think that's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a good thing. You know, there's still enough choices out there to handle most of your typical homeowner concerns outside of things like maybe termite control and some serious type infestations, you know.
Right.
So there's that aspect is in a different category. It's actually licensed by the Consumer Affairs Board down in Sacramento in a different division. But the Ag Commissioners are responsible for enforcement on those arenas also. It's a little bit different than agricultural operations. For example, I wouldn't go out and license a homeowner to apply a pesticide they could buy at the store. But I would maybe require a license of a agricultural producer who's going to spray his field of alfalfa for weevils, for example. And if he's using a product that's somewhat dangerous, he would have to have not only a permit to spray and put that material on his field and diagram what that field was and what the crop is, he would have to have a private applicator's license himself in order to apply that or to supervise its use. So it's a pretty stringent set of rules that pesticide use programs are involved in. And not every step of the way, there's an Ag Commissioner oversight. The Ag Commissioners also have a liaison with the Department of Pesticide Regulation, where we work together to try to make sure our programs are pretty standardized throughout the state, and that we're kind of looking at all the same important aspects of safety for the environment, safety for the applicator, safety for the people that are going to consume the food that are being treated.
We hear all the time from these environmental groups that, you know, farmers are just running around, you know,
spraying
polluting
stuff.
The world.
Yeah.
No controls.
Now, I heard recently that Roundup, which is, I believe, in certain concentrations, they have to be licensed to spray that, is now showing up in a lot of our groundwater. Is that the case?
Not that I've heard. Groundwater contamination has not been a factor in that. There's been a lot of controversy about glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, effect on the environment and into people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably one of the most used compounds in the world.
I know. It's really popular. Discovery. Now, when you hear stories like that, I mean, where could a person go to verify? Like when you hear, oh, Roundup's in all the groundwater in the California water basin.
Did you read that on Facebook?
No, I read it on the internet. But
it must be true.
It must be true.
Look no further.
That's right.
The internet. Internet never has anything wrong.
No.
Double check it with Facebook.
So where would you go? Would you go to the Ag Commissioner to verify, or if you hear stories like that? I mean, I'm sure you don't want everybody calling you every 5 minutes every time they hear a story or read something on the internet, but is there like a resource a person could go to find out that type of information?
Absolutely. You can go to the Ag Commissioner. That's one of the things that we are tasked with doing is answer questions and provide outreach.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And every county has one. So that'd be the first place to go and verify any of these stories. Cause gosh, there's stories about everything now anymore.
Yeah, but there's other places that are available. One is to go to the Department of Pesticide Regulations webpage in Sacramento.
Okay. All right.
The second one is to go to the Environmental Protection Agency's website. Both of those will offer you, from the regulatory standpoint, information. There's a lot of misinformation out there because it sells.
Sure.
typically a fearful message
fear from somebody. Yeah, fear is very popular.
That's right. But the people that are tasked with providing you with a safe, you know, and reasonable access to some of these compounds have been carefully vetted in most cases these products have by these agencies.
You certainly hope so.
Nice. Well, before we move on to something new, we better take another quick break because we got behind on the last one. We're back on track. So we're chatting with Jim Smith. He's the Ag Commissioner up in Siskiyou County, and you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
She was 84 when her kin folks came for a month or more. Now from overwork, she's on the other shore. Much too late was y'all come back, and it says in the Farmer's Almanac, it says, visitors and fish smell after 3 days. Our leader was a silver-tongued man. He deceived the people of the land. And when he got caught, he couldn't stand. It's a little offbeat and a little off track, but it says in the Farmer's Almanac, it says, in rivers and bad government, the lightest things float to the top.
Farmer, I've been married 10 years to the farmer's dollar. I got two boys in the county 4-H. I'm a lifetime sponsor of the FFA. Hey, that's what I make. I make a lot of hay for a little pay. But I'm proud to say I'm a God-fearing, hard-working combine driver. Hogging up the road with my flower. Chugging, lugging, lugging 5 miles an hour. On my international harvester.
Oh, boy.
Bill gave me crap for playing a bunch of Billy Joel. I'm like, all right, I am playing different stuff today. I like that song. I think it's fun.
Yeah.
So before we zoom back into Ag Commissioner land, I found the phone number for Charles at AirCo. So if your air conditioner is busted and you live in Redding or nearby, phone number is 530-510-7362, and that's Charles at AIRECO, AIRECO. Airco. Airco Heating.
Yeah. Highly recommend.
Cooling is implied. I guess it's just called Airco Heating, and you figure out that there's also a cooling. Now we care about the cooling. So it's 530-510-7362.
So, Jim, we're talking about unsolicited advertisement there. We were talking about herbicides, pesticides, things that the Ag Commissioner controls there. Yeah. Now, what about livestock, commercial?
Because we were talking about predation, but that was before the show.
Yeah. Well, that's a good one, too.
Yeah.
So livestock pest control is usually done under the guidance and direction of veterinarians, you know, doctors of veterinary medicine. Sometimes some of the materials may be under our jurisdiction, but most of the time that's done under their purview.
Okay.
Pesticide use reports are still filed with our office, and that's included in our pesticide use reports that go to the state. So there are some other arenas that we operate in. So, you know, pesticide happens to be just one program that we operate in. It's a pretty important one in California because, as you know, California is the number one agriculture state in the nation. You know, it has about $47 billion in cash receipts for agricultural products.
Well, and they're trying to whittle that down, but yeah, we're still a pretty big deal.
Yeah, if they take the water away from any of the growing areas, it's going to have a drastic impact on
sure,
that.
Sure, sure. Just ask the folks in the Central Valley.
Yeah, we're busy creating the second big Dust Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wouldn't that be something? So the you know, with the changes that may be occurring in our environment, the planning that is going on and dealing with, you know, resource allocation going to become critical. And agriculture is a pretty important aspect of that. So if your listeners are paying attention, you know, they want to make sure that that's addressed in a way that will protect their food supply. I don't particularly want to become a person eating Chinese developed and raised food when and turning California to a dust bowl. That's not my kind of ideal.
Well, you know, that brings up a really good point. You know, when you go to the grocery store and you buy your fruits and vegetables, more and more we're seeing crops that are not grown here. A lot of South American crops, a lot of Mexico crops. How do we know that that those growers are following the rules that we have to follow, and that we're not getting fruits and vegetables that have been sprayed with pesticides or herbicides that are detrimental to us? I mean, they have people on the ground there, and then our own people that certify that stuff before it comes in?
So that's a really, really, really good question. And I'm going to start out by talking about interstate differences. In many states in the United States use the federal government's EPA guidelines for the regulatory processes. So, for example, right across the border from Siskiyou County up here, we have Oregon. And I can have a grower that actually farms in California and Oregon. Let's just use mint, for example. They have a weed control program that works very well for some really nasty weeds in mint and Tule Lake or in Oregon in the Klamath County side of things that are registered by the EPA. California has our own EPA. It's a Department of Pesticide Regulation with its own rules that are more stringent than the federal government guidelines. And so the guy in Oregon is the same guy. He can use this product on his mint and not have any of these nasty weeds. And the guy in California is struggling very hard to figure out how to control those particular weeds because he doesn't have any particular tools that will address that particular weed.
Because the California regulations don't allow him to use that same product?
That's exactly right. So when he harvests that product, though, he takes it to the same place to distill the mint oil. And, it's been adjusted safe by the EPA. It's been tested and a tolerance has been established. And sometimes that tolerance is zero, which happens a lot. But the material's intermixed anyway. So it sometimes creates a hardship for the people in California as opposed to other states in the nation. But even so, the United States has the safest food supply of the world currently. Testing for other countries' exports into our country are done on a regular basis. The Department of Pesticide Regulation has a whole division down there, and that's what they're tasked with doing. They test products coming in from overseas. They test products coming in from South America and Central America and Mexico on a regular basis. If they find anything that exceeds a safe tolerance or happens to be an illegal pot product, then they quarantine that and destroy it. And they do find some things periodically. There's a list that you can find on the DPR's website that lists some of the things that are commonly or at least recently found to be in violation that have been removed from the market. Unfortunately, what they use in some of those countries is you know, maybe written in a certain way, but there isn't any enforcement that we have or can bring to bear on if that's actually the way it is. But we can test the material coming in, you know, to our marketplace. And so just to make people aware, most of the stuff that you get to eat from South America, you know, buying grapes in the wintertime, for example, is definitely going to be safe because our market is very, very attractive to those farmers down there. They don't want to risk that whatsoever. So most of the time, everything's pretty copacetic. There isn't too many issues with those things. There's a few things once in a while that, that show up.
What another one of the real, I think, hot commodities right now is organic. We see organic.
That sends Bill into a rage every time he sees it.
Yeah.
Just a little.
Okay. Well, organic, well, you get everything from organic eggs to organic broccoli, or I mean, everything's organic now. What are the guidelines, and what is the verification process for organic?
Is it actually different?
Is it is it really any different than, you know, because they charge a lot more for organic foods, and I don't think but I don't think the end user has the ability. Their own means to verify if something's organic or not. What's the process for that?
So organic production is regulated by the National Organic Program Act that was passed by Congress. And it's an act that delineates how that program is to be operated. And the legal operation is pretty well spelled out. And you can do this, you can't do that. And it's overseen by a certifying agency. So a certifier is a company that's been registered and acknowledged by the and licensed by the USDA NOPA program. So they're officially designated a USDA-approved certifying agency. For example, in California, the California Certified Organic Farmers is one of the certifiers, and they will go out and take an application from a grower who wants to become a organic farmer, and they'll sit down and they'll draw a program up for the farm, which delineates how they'll transition from their conventional program into an organic program. So they'll stop using pesticides and commercial fertilizers at that point in time, and it takes about 3 years to transition into a true organic program. So once that field becomes, or cow herd or whatever, becomes 3 years into the program, it's now certifiable as an organic producer.
And does that grower get like a certificate? Because you see a lot of these farmers markets that have organic growers. Do they have a certificate they can show you to prove that what they're selling is organic?
Yes, they do. If they are selling it as organic, they have a certificate that proves that. And they also get a certified producer certificate if they're at a farmer's market that they can show you. And each one of those documents, it verifies that that growers meeting the rules for organic production.
And that's a state document, is that correct?
The certified organic producer document is, definitely. Okay. The certified producer's document is not necessarily a guarantee that he has organic produce. He's just the guy that raised the food. I guess that's the difference between those two. I got to delineate that. The organic program is also overseen by the state California Department of Food and Ag's organic program. So we have also an organic act that was passed in 2003, I think. And as such, any organic grower is required to register and go through periodic inspections by the ag commissioner's offices or some individual special investigators with the California Department of Food and Ag's organic program.
So could organic growers from different states operate under different rules?
No, not really. There may be a little more stringent rules in California because you can make them a little more stringent. But the National Organic Program Act is what kind of sets the tone.
Okay.
The strictures of that act are implemented by the organic certifiers. So some certifiers are more strict about some things than others. So it's a little, there's a little bit of difference in some of those parameters. But if you buy an organically certified product, you can be assured that it's not going to have been treated with a pesticide per se, other than an organic pesticide, which there are some things out there that are usable. Ones that are like vinegar, for example, cinnamon oil and vinegar for maybe some weed control. It actually burns the young weeds down. Sulfur, if it's mined, you know, for powdery mildew control on some of the grapes or some of the cucurbits or things that have a powdery mildew problem. So there's some actual organic pesticides out there that can be used, but they're organic. It's a little bit different than when you typically spray a pesticide on a crop for a bug, you know, the bug dies. So it's a little bit different.
Interesting. Okay, we have to take a really quick break, and then we're going to come right back.
Yeah, because I got the million-dollar question next.
Bill.
Yeah. Well, everybody wants to know. This is interesting
spoiler
stuff.
Spoiler alert, Bill is the million-dollar question. No pressure. Yeah. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
When I get off of this mountain, you know where I want to go. Straight down the Mississippi River to the Gulf of Mexico. The Lake Charles, Louisiana, little Bessie girl I once knew. She told me just to come on by if there's anything that she could do. Up on Cripple Creek, she sends me if I spring a leak. She mends me. I don't have to speak, but she defends me. A drunkard's dream if I ever did see one.
Six lanes, tail lights. Red ants marching into the night. They disappear to the left and right again. Another supper from a sack. A 99-cent heart attack. I got a pounding head and an aching back. And the camel's buried in a big straw stack. I'm gonna live where the green grass grows. Watch my corn pop up in rows. Every night be tucked. Raise our kids where the good Lord's blessed. Point our rocking chairs towards the west. And plant our dreams where the peaceful river flows. Where the green grass grows.
Well, there you go.
And now we know why there's green grass.
Yeah, there's green grass. Speaking of green grass, we were talking about organic certification, and I've been hearing, you know, a friend told me that
you read it on Facebook.
Yeah, I read it on Facebook that this marijuana people are buying is there's in a lot of cases no certification process for it, and they use a lot of dangerous chemicals to grow it. What's being done to make sure when I go down and buy my my herb that it's safe?
Bill. and he's lying about that, by the way.
Yeah, by the way. Yeah, so is that organic or is that certified? What's the story with that?
So because the organic program is authorized by the federal government NOPA program, the National Organic Program, right?
Right.
It means that that federally mandated or authorized program cannot be applied to illegal products like cannabis.
Right, so because it's federally legal, so they don't have to follow the organic rules.
But they claim it's
but they can say it's organic.
Well, they can't sell it as a certified organic product because no certifier is authorized to provide that certification just yet.
Okay.
There's still some stuff going on in Congress, but that's where that decision is going to be made on the status of cannabis in the future. Currently, cannabis is a regulated drug by the U.S. government. It's authorized by a bunch of states so far, but not all by any means. Cannabis, as far as the organic program is concerned, is not authorized to be done in an organic manner. You can't sell cannabis as an organic product. If you're doing so, then you're running afoul of the organic program itself and can be held under a violation notice. Can't do that.
Yeah.
Hemp is in the same boat. Currently, you can't raise hemp in California yet. There's still some rules that we're working on, and it has the same limitation. You can't raise organic hemp because you can't raise hemp anyway, but it's in the same boat because it's also regulated by the federal government. There are some concerns. I've had some very serious concerns up here in Siskiyou County. Sheriff John Lopey, who is an excellent sheriff, great partner in working with the Ag Commissioner's Office in all aspects. Department's very supportive and cooperative, and has been on quite a few raids in the last couple years in marijuana grows, cannabis grows that are exceeding the limitations of numbers. Yeah, you know, they're exceeding the numbers of legal requirements. They're not being grown inside. Siskiyou County has a ban on commercial production of cannabis. So the production here has to be limited to recreational or medical. And so they're out policing that as best they can. It's a phenomenal job. We've had a lot. We had 4,500 new residents in Siskiyou County. That's about 20% population increase. You know, Siskiyou County's big, but it doesn't have a large population. And many of those came in to raise cannabis for the marketplace. So we have people that are protecting their products at all costs from any threat to their plants. And every single raid that our sheriff was on, he discovered carbofuran insecticide containers, and evidence around every plant was that it had been applied to the soil around every plant, and it had been watered in. It's a systemic insecticide. It's illegal in California. It's illegal to use on any crop in California. It's dangerous. Part of the reason it's not legal to use in California anymore because of its toxicity. And it's a carbamate insecticide, which is a family of chemicals that cause a certain type of reaction in people. And there were Facebook posts on, you know, some of the local grapevine Facebook programs 2 years ago where they were describing pretty much carbamate poisoning from ingesting too much of the honey oil that they were getting from some of the plants they were extracting. And
so much for the natural product that functions as medicine.
Yeah. Well, so it was serious enough to where I put a public notice out warning people that they needed to really know where they're getting their material. So if you go to a dispensary to get your product, especially now as these new rules are taking effect, you're going to find that your products are tested for pesticides in them prior to being authorized for sale. So this program that's been implemented has taken a little while to get going. It's still got some growing pains to go through, but it's definitely got some focus on how to make sure those products are going to be safe for your consumers. So you buy it from a dispensary, you're going to be pretty well assured that it's going to be safe and it came from a legitimate producer who's not doing things like that.
Okay.
Up here, they're even using it, you know, to get rid of, you know, things like deer or other threats to their grows. You know, it becomes a pretty effective bait in some cases.
It's, oh, my gosh. So they're killing the animals to keep them away from the plants?
Yep, that's exactly right. So it's a pretty dangerous thing.
Another benefit.
We really want to discourage that, you know. Definitely buy your stuff at a legitimate, you know, dispensary or something in California.
Or just go get a job and live happily ever after. And
hey.
Oh, sorry.
That spaghetti sauce last night put you to sleep. Hey.
And yet another reason to never eat spaghetti, besides the fact I don't like noodles. Now you know why. It's because Bill's always trying to slip me a Mickey. What the hell?
I just hear a lot of bad things about it, and
yeah, that's
I just
and it poisons the people who go out in law enforcement and take out these illegal grows,
exactly.
And it gets into the water systems, and you know,
so that's that whole thing. You know, starts coming to bear, and because you know we regulate agricultural production, pesticide use in agricultural production, food, feed, and fiber, we regulate that, and there's still some question about what. Cannabis is, but we have several pilot programs ongoing where the state's actually working with the counties and implementing a regulatory program in some of those counties that have authorized commercial production. So it's all in a flux and it's being developed right now. And I'm sure that by the time we get it completed, it'll be pretty much safe product. And we'll try to, the sheriff's going to be trying to address all of our sheriffs, trying to address the issue with illegal production because, you know, we have 4,500 growers here. And, you know, the market in Oregon is that there's a producer for every 9 users. Well,
wow.
It's oversupplied. So, you know, what's happening is the price goes down when the product's oversupplied. Farmers in California, United States, pretty much know how to do that. They just start farming, and pretty soon the price goes down to nothing, and they have to struggle to try to make profit, you know?
Yeah, no
kidding. So the same thing is happening in the cannabis markets, except for the fact that there are states that don't allow production of cannabis. It's still illegal in some of those states, so the price is being maintained. So, for example...
So they'll come running here. Hey, Jim, we're going to get cut off by the news here.
Go ahead.
Because we're not smoking pot, so we have to have a schedule. we'll be right back. We're going to talk to Jim Smith, the Ag Commissioner in Siskiyou County, next hour. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Declare a state of emergency.
Welcome back to the second hour of We the People. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Team Power.
Team Power is our local... Turn your back to me to do it so I can't distract you.
Stop looking at me. Our Team Power is our local John Deere Kubota tractor dealer in Shasta Lake, just north of Redding. They're on Twin View Boulevard, 3119, and just south of Phil's Propeller. You can reach them at 226-9226 or on the web at readingtractors.com. Give them a call. You need tractors, service, parts. They do it all down there. Give them a call.
Yeah, and a little unsolicited commercial here for Charles at AIRECO, AIREco Heating and Cooling. His phone number is 530-510-7362. So if your air conditioner is busted and you're in the city of Reading, tell you what, Charles actually cares that your air conditioner is broken. And okay, that's not secondary to the fact that he can fix it. Actually, primarily he can fix it, but he also actually cares, which is nice. And shows up on time and all those good things, which is marvelous. He's been in business like 30 years, I think is what he told me. But such so Charles at Airco, and I'll give his number again. It's 530-510-7362. And we like him so much because he saved us from our house being 92 degrees inside, which was magical. The cans in the cupboard were hot. It was crazy.
Yeah, it was hot. It was unlivable.
It was before the fire.
Yeah, Bill was out. I'm out.
Yeah, Aaron was out. Aaron was out, too.
Yeah.
We're done. So anyway, if you're having that situation and you're not getting results or you don't know who to call, I'd call Charles, frankly. He would be my first choice. And let's see. So back to our regularly scheduled program. We're here chatting with Jim Smith. He's the Ag Commissioner in Siskiyou County, and we did a program with him last week. So if you want to find out what a sealer does, because your ag commissioner in your county is also the sealer, they do all the weights and measures. And we had an extensive conversation on how that works. I think you'd be really interested in that, actually. And now you'll know what those little tags are on the gas pump and on the scales at the store and all the rest of it. And
They're out there watching out for you.
That was July 29th we did, and I've got a link to that on the site. And so today's August 5th, just in case we replay this and you're wondering what's going on. We're still having the fire in Reading. Little commercial note there.
Yeah, still, I don't think we've seen blue sky now for a couple of months.
I had to go to 6,000 feet yesterday to see blue sky. I had to go pick up a lamb from the butcher shop when I ordered it. I neglected to note it was 2 hours away.
By the time she got home with it, it was smoked lamb. It was had its own, its own flavor.
I had to bring a little buzzard back into Smokeville. It's brutal when you tell a rancher, yeah, sure, I'd like one of your lambs. That'd be great. He goes, okay, well, we're going to butcher, you know, blah, blah, blah. We get done with all that. And he said, I said, well, you know, who do you use for a butcher? Where do you want me to pick it up? Oh, we use Idaho Grocery. And I'm like, Idaho Grocery? I don't know those guys. Oh, they're in Susanville. It's 2 hours away. But you know what? I have to say, if you want a really great butcher shop, Idaho Grocery in Susanville is amazing. And they have every kind of spice or marinade or I've never seen that many sauces, spices, anything that you could use on like, you know, beef, chicken, if you have to eat chicken for some reason.
What about rabbit?
Again, I don't know why you'd want to do that. Pork, they got everything, but they're a great butcher shop. So there's more unsolicited. God, we love private industry. You go private industry. Okay. So Jim, Talk to us about we talk a lot about the Klamath Basin. We have done some programs about that, but we can't get too far into this without discussing the economic impact on that area if, in fact, they shut the water off. And I mean, this will happen again. It isn't just this year. They've been doing this for years. The water's on, the water's off, the water's on, the water's off. How many people are affected by this? How much agriculture and how much money? Because when the environmentalists, the tribes, the government, when all this stuff rolls in and shuts the water off, the one thing that's never considered and never part of the equation is the people who live there, the people who make a living there, and the people who need the products that come from that area.
Now, are you talking about the dam removal situation or just the irrigation?
No, I'm just talking about the irrigation.
Okay, they want to shut the irrigation water off.
Well, yeah, they have. A couple of times, you know, and they had the big bucket brigade up there in 2001, and now we're back at it again. And the court decision we were going to talk about last week actually got punted. What do you think, Jim? You think that decision to shut the water off and mitigate for the stupid fish up there, you think that'll go past the growing season? Because that's kind of what it looks like.
I'm pretty sure it will. I think that by the time Oregon court, which is now a new requirement to entertain that motion for an injunction on turning the water off by the tribe, Klamath Tribe, will probably take a while to get into place.
And the really fun part for people who don't, for the people who don't follow the drama up there, that actually the kind of funny part is the judge in San Francisco who was hearing the case brought by the Klamath Tribe against the Bureau of Reclamation to shut the water off to the irrigators so they could have more water for the sucker fish who actually thrive in low water. But that's a whole different story. When that went to San Francisco, there was an amicus brief that went in from Siskiyou County, Modoc County, and the Modoc tribe. And the Modoc tribe weighed in and said, actually, they don't need all that water. We're not in favor of it. And so the judge looked at one tribe wants the water off, one tribe wants the water on. Hey, you know what? This would be a better case to hear in Oregon.
Yep. I think he probably got a little bit concerned about having to make a decision on that. He also told the tribe that they didn't have enough evidence for an injunction considering the level of hurt that would be applied to the local communities, and kind of gave the tribes something to reconsider if they're going to actually pursue it in an Oregon court. I guess we will see how that bores out. I'm not sure I could actually address that, but I'm concerned that they will go ahead and try to introduce an injunction. The unfortunate thing is that a little bit of review might be of interest. You know, in 2001, the government shut the water off based upon the sucker fish endangered species. And after the fact, you know, after that year when there wasn't any water, you know, personal property was impacted by taking away water rights. Those are actually property that people own, and that includes the farmers in the project. That was taken away without any recourse, and they actually have admitted that there was no reason to have shut the water off completely during that period of time. However, there was very little, if any, compensation offered to anybody that had a water right that was restricted on that issue. They actually threw that out of court. So in 2001, the water was turned off. The Army came in, of course. I'm being a little facetious here, but they were guarding the head gates so that the rowdy Klamath Basin farmers wouldn't storm the gates and turn the water on so they could irrigate their crops.
Horrible farmers.
You know, but they were out there with their machine guns, and, you know, we had our local law enforcement was present, which really helped mitigate some of the hot feelings that were going out there. Most of our sheriffs and local law enforcement, we have a healthy respect for them. The folks up in the North State are very supportive of our local law enforcement agent. I think that had a mitigating effect when you consider the wealth of federal agents that were parked around that head gate in 2001. So, you know, give them a little compliment. I think the sheriffs did a good job at toning that down. It probably saved a lot of people from further issues. So, let's go on a little bit more. The lawsuits continue to flow. Environmental groups have often told me that their intent, in addition to get a wild and scenic river that has no barriers from the headwaters of the Klamath River to the ocean, they also want to establish the Everglades of the West, which means they want to turn back the clock and run all the water back into the Klamath project as a marsh, a large marsh. And that means getting rid of everybody out there. So to that aim, environmental groups have banded together. The tribe has used that Endangered Species Act to garner more power and influence and maybe money, in addition to protecting their subsistence food, which is a Lost River sucker found in the Long Nose, Short Nose sucker fish found in Klamath Lake, which, you know, if you actually saw somebody eat one of those, I'd be pretty impressed.
I was going to say, except for the fact they taste like dirt, so nobody's actually subsisting on those. We have to take a really quick break to ponder that. The fish that tastes like dirt is now
nobody eats that we have to protect.
That no one eats that we have to protect, that lives in low water, that needs more water. So we can turn off all the farming. Yeah. Now we're into that part of the program. So we hope you'll hang with us. It won't make any sense at the end, but you'll enjoy it. At least we'll have some good mocking. We'll be right back.
She thinks my tractor. She thinks my tractor's sexy. It really turns her on. She's always staring at me while I'm chugging along. She likes the way it's pulling while we're tilling up the land. She's even kind of crazy about my farmer's tan.
tractor sexy. She thinks my tractor sexy. She thinks my tractor sexy.
And we're back. All right, Jim. So if they shut the water off there, up there, give us a bird's eye view. What does that translate into, and why should people care?
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. Infrastructure okay. impacts from that have never been overcome. It shut down a bunch of businesses and around the project areas that depend upon those farmers for their livelihood. Many of the farm laborers that have been working there for, you know, a generation or two, some of them had to go away to find work so they could survive, and they never came back. So there's always a challenge in finding enough labor to operate a farm, you know, these days. It's a pretty big challenge. The impact to the economy was even greater than that. So in Siskiyou County, we have about the potential for up to $400 million in revenues from agricultural crops. And out of that $400 million, you know, $84 million are directly attributable to ground over in the Tule Lake arena, which is in the project, which is a pretty significant percentage of the total revenues for the whole county. Because the total revenues include cattle and timber, which are pretty diverse and spread out over most of the county. We have a great big county. So the impact to Siskiyou County was that those farmers did not have $84, $85 million in revenue. They had whatever handouts they could garner from emergency programs from the government. Unfortunately, when you give a handout to a grower, for example, which they did have some, they gave, you know, the dime. Willie Riggs at Oregon State University came up with a scenario that I'd like to kind of tell you about, probably did last time too. But a grower, you know, he sells his crop and he has like 10 dimes in his hand, for example, just for example. And he takes one of those dimes and he gives it to the tractor guy, and he takes a dime and gives it to the fertilizer guy, and he takes a dime and gives it to every one of the businesses that he supports. And then when he gets done, he has a dime in his hand, just everything went well and he had a profit. So when you get into a position where they can't farm because there's no water, you gotta have water to raise a crop, all he may get is that dime or a percentage of that dime from a handout to try to keep him alive to maybe survive and start growing the next year, if that happens. But that dime in his hand isn't spread out to anybody else in the community. None of the infrastructure gets that support when things go wrong. So in 2001, a farmer got a dime. None of the rest of them, the tractor guy didn't get any, none of the other infrastructure that there to support the farms and the community got anything out of that. And many of them have not recouped from that. So we've had four or five of those hammers in that area of Siskiyou County delivered to our infrastructure over the last, since 2001. There's been four or five water curtailments, water shutoffs, requirements for alternative water sources. They've restricted our ability to take what had been typically given to us out of the lakes for irrigation and made us pump water out of the ground. And now we have potential for overdrafting water, groundwater.
Not to mention the cost of pumping is huge.
And the cost of pumping is horrible. And so, you know, costs have gone up and water availability has gone down. So we're looking at, 225,000 acres in round figures of project farm ground, because this happens in Oregon, in Siskiyou County and Modoc County, and not just in one county. So estimates are $557 million of agricultural revenue. There's about 4,500 jobs directly related to agriculture in the Klamath Basin, in the Klamath Project. And multipliers for every dollar generated in revenue is about another 91 cents for the community. So the Klamath Project is about a $1 billion project. And that's restricted big time when you don't have any water. So the employment multiplier, so every job that we have in agriculture, there's 0.6 of a job is created in the community. So 0.6, almost one. So you almost get another 4,500 jobs related to, agricultural production in Siskiyou County or in the Klamath Project. So every time you lose all that, you're looking at some major losses in the communities that we're operating in, not just in the infrastructure. So the infrastructure is a hamburger joint that feeds your people at lunchtime, the tire store that fixes your flats and sells you the tires, the guy that's the hardware store selling you all the nuts and bolts and everything else. He's got the irrigation guy that's selling his parts and pumps and fixing stuff for the irrigation systems. You know, the guy that's at the corner grocery store selling, dinner to you guys, restaurants that might survive in town, the guy fixing your car and your truck and stuff. None of those guys stay in business if there isn't a healthy economy there. And we lost a lot of them. And in a small community where there's low population levels and a hard way to make a living in the first place, you got to struggle to find a way to make a living in these small communities. It's pretty hard to recoup losses that have been generated from this fight that we are constantly in, trying to maintain access to water.
Yeah, and what happens is those folks can't make a living. The restaurant guy, the hardware guy, they move out of the area and they go where they can make a living, and so you get your water back the next year. That infrastructure's already collapsed.
Already flat, yep. So we've lost a number of growers since 2001 directly attributed to these shutoffs. We've lost infrastructure in the arena of potato packing plants that could be associated with low prices, but is without having a steady product to sell. Sometimes that has the impact of reducing contracts, because some of the products that we raise are based upon contracted crop production. So if you don't provide the agreed upon product, you lose your contract the next time around. So we've lost some of those things also. Little catch 22 that some of these people that are attacking the agricultural systems up in the Klamath Project area, as well as the water rights issues, are very well informed about. And currently this year, the gloves came off and everybody and their brothers is involved in a court suit against Klamath Project irrigators, and that includes all the tribes. We're talking about water downriver that's been reserved this year. No water was turned on when it was normally turned on in April because of a requirement to hold 50,000 acre feet in the lake for this flush flow. Well, the flush flow is supposed to wash out all these parasites to get into coho salmon and save them from, dying because of this parasite. There's very little evidence that that's successful, and there's some evidence that shows that it's not successful. And in fact, 1 year, 2 years ago or so, the flush flows that are required by a biological opinion were actually going to have happened during a major flood stage in the Klamath River.
Yeah, they were going to wash out the highway. It's like, yeah, no.
Yeah. So what are these people thinking? Sometimes I wonder. It's, if the flush flows worked that well, then that flood flow would probably have taken care of the problem, right?
You would think.
Why would they need to add more water to an already flood flow Klamath River? So a lot of controversy, questions and things. And if you look at it in a common sense way, and I'm prejudiced, I'm a member of the Tulevik Irrigation District, as my family members, you know, there's definitely enough to go around. Contrary to what people say, contrary to what people think, it's just a conflict between powers and treaty rights, which are very powerful, powerful rights. And, you know, the intent of people trying to garner an agenda item such as the Everglades of the West being reestablished there, you know. So things that affect the county, every single one of those reductions in income affected the county tax revenues. Counties have a hard time making up for the mandated spending plans that the state gives them anyway. And put this on top of that, it gives them even less money to deal with the local requirements to support the government, which is, you know, the policeman that comes and helps you when you have a problem with a bad guy.
Yeah, police, fire, social services. When we we come back, Jim, give people some numbers on, you know, the dollar value of agriculture that gets lost in all of that. So what's going out of the food? You know, what's coming off of the food production line that people won't see if they take all of that out. We're going to come right back with Jim Smith. He is the Ag Commissioner up in Siskiyou County, and you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
He's a cold beer drinker, a buck and deer hunter, the best friend a dog ever had. A post-hole digger, a men's skull dipper, a John Deere cap sporting man. With a house on a hill and a pond in the field surrounded by a mess of cornrows. Makes a living from his labor, a credit to the maker. He's somebody everybody knows. Last of a dying breed who tend the fields and mend the fences. Heaven knows I hate to think that generation might be ending. But if he goes, he will go down in history. Last of the overall wearers, farmer tan terrors down at the VFW hall. Cape pan liquors, ripe tomato pickers, hay balers, loading trailers in the fall.
Nothing left for my kids and my wife. Oh, I clung to that first cup of coffee, praying God, won't you show me what's real. Out in the distance, I saw through the window a man on a tractor with a dog in the field. Oh, the dog walked just like he was smiling. The man drove like the world was alright. The tractor hummed on like part of a song that you sing to your children at night. His work was laid out there before him. In rows of green, his whole life was revealed. Oh, what I wouldn't give if I could just live like a man on a tractor with a dog in a field.
All right. The man on the tractor with the dog in the field, we take those guys all off the ground. What are we losing just in that one area? Jim? Do we put Jim in the cone of silence?
What's that?
Oh, there you go. You were in the cone of silence there for just a second.
Oh. Are we back?
We are.
Oh, sorry. I was looking at this Facebook post that I thought was quite interesting.
You got lured in by Facebook.
Yeah.
We've been joking about it all afternoon.
I can buy my pair of dirty jeans for $400 from Nordstrom. I thought that was a pretty good offer.
Does it have rips in them? Because that's really the part I look for is the rips.
I don't think it has any rips. They're just dirty. They're dirty jeans.
Yeah, so. Yeah. That's terrific. Go make sense of that. I see these ripped up dirty things and I'm like, And I know you paid extra for that. Inexplicable. Yeah. So if you took all these guys off the ground up there and they got their way, you know, they got their magical whatever they're doing up there that doesn't involve any agriculture, what have we taken out of the system? Give people an idea of just the volume that we're talking about.
$1 billion out of the Klamath project would go away. About 9,000 jobs would go away. The value of the ground that was taxed at about $5,000 an acre to each of the county governments would be going away.
And that's approximately how many acres?
255,000 acres. With about an average value, current value of $5,000, which is a little bit shaky right now with all the threats to the water system, but the last sales that occurred in the basin were in the $5,000 range. And so, even without water, if they just turned the water off, an unreliable water supply would reduce the value of that ground considerable, you know, probably $1,000 an acre if it was dry land. It's a desert up there. You get about 13 inches of rain in a good year on average. And we would lose a lot of products. We have a multitude of different kind of crops that are raised up there. For example, they raise barley, wheat, oats, alfalfa for hay, grass, hay, cereal grain, hay. We raise potatoes. A lot of them are contract potatoes that they raise for potato chips. So if you eat an In-N-Out burger, you're eating a Klamath Project potato because they supply all the potatoes for In-N-Out burger up in our country.
Well, good for them.
Well, yeah. They need to advertise that a little bit more.
I like In-N-Out Burger even more.
Stop their screaming. Yeah, they don't want to lose their...
Well, I should say French fries, not
French fries. Yeah.
French fries. Yeah,
well, but
sorry.
If you're British, it's chips. So, you know, we're good. We're okay. Covered. Our little friends across the pond.
I'm part English. I guess that passes.
There you go.
So other things we raise, strawberry nursery plants. So in the project, there's a number of strawberry nurseries. They also raised raspberries for roots and for canes, and they ship them all over the world. The dollar figures for some of the nursery crops in the basin are enormous. In fact, if you eat a strawberry in California or Oregon, or not necessarily all Oregon, they still have some canning strawberry types up there. But most likely, the strawberries you eat have been raised on a plant that came from McDowell or Butte Valley or Tule Lake or Klamath County. Most of them in the project area. So, yeah. And we raise dehydrator onions, mint for like peppermint oil. We raise horseradish. The West Coast capital of the horseradish production area is in Tule Lake, actually. We have microgreen lettuce, and we raise carrots and carrot seed. So we have a pretty wide range of diverse crops, nothing like what you find down south, of course, but for a cold climate with 110 or 120 on a good year-day growing season, that's not too shabby. Considering that they also took 60 days of our growing season away from us at the beginning of the year, the crops actually look pretty good over there so far. What they will do this year based upon yield and quality is kind of up in the air still because it's short season. I'm just hoping they're going to meet the minimum requirements for grade so they get big enough and they can be sold. We're still wondering if that's going to happen also.
Yeah, because if they don't make grade, everything just gets plowed under, doesn't it?
Now they may find an alternative method to use them. So they sell them for pennies on the dollar to maybe a guy that has a bunch of cows to feed. But it's definitely a big loss, so it would be a bad deal.
Yeah.
So some of these things cost a lot of money to raise. I wanted to address that. People, you know, you look at farms and you probably don't realize that it takes a lot of capital to do farming. So let's take a potato, for example. You know, they're paying $5,000 or $6,000 an acre to raise a potato. And if they get $6 or $7 per sack on a good yield, they might break even. So they need to have a little bit more money than that to make money. And oftentimes they cost, the profit percentage is pretty dadgum low. So I may go a couple years without even making any money. And then the one year that they're going to make money, the tribe has a suit against them and the water gets turned off. So it puts them into a very big disadvantage economically, unfairly in some cases, you know, on this, how do you go to your bank and borrow money for a business that doesn't have the reliable, you know, inputs that you need to complete the deal?
Well, that's something that I don't think a lot of people understand is these farmers go to a bank every year and borrow money to put that crop in the ground, and that money gets repaid after the crop comes off, and you have a bad year and that crop doesn't pay the loan, you're going to have a hard time going back to that bank the next year when you still haven't repaid the year before. It's
very difficult.
Very difficult.
And it's especially ironic if the cause of that isn't Mother Nature, which farmers deal with every single year, or some unforeseen circumstance that is also dealt with a lot of times. But it happens to be a lawsuit that, you know, curtails and needed input without notice, such as the 2001 water cutoff that was like came out of nowhere. The government shut off the water and everybody in the whole country was left holding a bag. Real fair deal.
Well, mm-hmm. And then, you know, a lot of times you have people who don't really deal with farming at all. That's a small percentage of our population. So a lot of people are decidedly unfamiliar with where their food originates. And you look at the other things that happen around farming, and we talked about that a bit last week with the leased lands around all the, you know, the wetland they have up there. And they've got, you know, that's a part of the Pacific Flyway. So you've got all these birds that are counting on, you know, stopping there during their travels. And you mess up that whole thing, too. I mean, there are a lot of integrated pieces to this whole thing. It isn't, I don't know, somehow people have this weird mistaken notion that, you know, farmers are just sitting around getting wealthy.
Yeah, they just got a bag full of money. They don't understand that that tractor he's got out there turning the soil, he borrowed money and has a loan against it, and that's got to be repaid.
Well,
and
like we have,
if it goes back to the tractor guy, then the tractor guy loses money. And
but see, I think people forget too. Like they look at, you know, we have farmers that are elected officials, so they look at their net worth and they're like, oh, well, that guy's a millionaire. Well, he has farmland, but that doesn't mean you can take it and buy fries from In-N-Out with it. You know, it's ground.
That's right.
It has value, but that's not liquid value. It's sitting there.
It can be, you know, definitely attacked by having situations like we've had where the water got turned off some of that, or the threat of that affects that value also. So
what was going on, you know, up there, Jim? We have like an hour. Oh, we have an hour. We have a minute before our next break. I guess my hours and minutes just rolled together. And we can carry it over into the next segment, but, you know, I'm always channeling, you know, some environmentalist hater in the back of my head that's going, well, you know, if all those farmers weren't there, we'd have this beautiful natural landscape, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's high desert up there. It's pretty darn dry. If these guys weren't putting water on the ground, I mean, this place turns into the high desert again.
Yeah. Tourist attraction.
Absolutely would. You know, there's a certain amount of groundwater, but it takes ages to get down and recharge. The other thing that you might keep in mind is that the project developed a bypass from Lost River to run into the Klamath River to provide more flow and to reduce the need to pump water clear through the Sheepy Peak area into lower Klamath Lake area. And so it wouldn't flood everything. They tried to change that right now. I believe the Endangered Species Act with the coho being involved would probably have something about along the lines of, well, you can't change the Klamath River's flow by rediverting Lost River back into Tule Lake. I think there would be some repercussions. Plus, you know, the land is in a 13 inches per year at best average rainfall area. So, you know, if they ever thought they had enough water to fill that all back up without waiting for hundreds of years, it's
yeah, good luck with that. Well, that's why before the Klamath Dams, it all went dry in the summer. A really quick break, and then we're going to come back with our guest, Jim Smith. He's the Ag Commissioner up there in Siskiyou County. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Still you wonder who's cheating who and who's being true. Who don't even care anymore. It makes you wonder who's doing right with someone tonight. Whose car is parked next door. Mississippi, she's calling my name. Catfish are jumping, that paddle wheel bumping. Black water keep rolling on fast just the same.
Oh, black water keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
We couldn't talk about all this water without playing that one. That was a must. All right, so Jim, we've got approximately 10 minutes left. Of course, we have burned through two more hours, and we didn't talk about predation, but we don't really have time. So what else do people need to know about the Klamath Project? I guess to be informed as they're reading all this, because really most of the stuff you read about that whole situation up there is propaganda.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. The things that people should be aware of is that water rights have been adjudicated, currently adjudicated, and that included a biological opinion for water flows. Lake levels were established to protect the sucker fish. There is research going on right now that's long-term and very expensive on the sucker fish themselves by the USGS biological research team. They've been there for about 10 years now, and they still don't have a good handle on why sucker fish have issues.
Oh, what a great taxpayer expense.
Jeez.
Terrific.
Yeah, so, you know, the juvenile retention thing is a pretty deal. You might keep in mind also that farmers have always advocated previously if we needed more sucker fish in the lake, we should raise them and turn them out when they're likely to survive if we can. And I'd like the people to know that we have an old lake. It's in its last stages of life. It's highly, you know, full of sediment, and it grows a lot of algae in it because it's warm water and it's shallow. And some of those things contribute to poor water quality downstream, but there's also some things that occur naturally up above Klamath Lake and some of the tributaries. Soil provides a lot of nutrients that, you know, promote the growth of this algae in the lake and has an effect on water quality, which everybody's concerned about, having high amounts of phosphorus and some other things naturally occurring. And oftentimes when the water is used for irrigation, the tailwater that runs back into the Klamath River, which is the water that we don't use, is clean. It doesn't have that phosphorus level in it because it's been taken out and attached to soil particles. So there's some benefits to some of the water coming back out of that. The amount of water that usually goes into, the TID arena is probably something less than what Lost River would have put back into the lake if that whole flow was diverted over there. So what we have is an interdependent group of dams and waterways that were designed to deliver water to farms and ranches at an 80% efficiency rating, which is a very, very, very high standard for irrigation systems, and to deliver the tailwater back into the Klamath River, which is cleaner than when it came out of the Klamath Lake. Those are all positive things that happen along with the $1 billion in revenue that is generated by that small area in the Oregon and California border.
And this could all be happening at the same. This could all be happening in concert, right? This really isn't an either or system because the conflict is really manufactured.
The conflict
makes it so annoying.
The conflict, unfortunately, is polarized to gain power and influence, no matter what the statements are, by the competing interests. I have interest in agriculture, and I pretty much support that. But I think most people realize that there is enough to go around. It becomes an issue when Klamath Lake waters are brought into question for downstream flows. Klamath Lake waters are hot, full of algae and material, and aren't really suitable habitat for anything in the Klamath River running downstream without the tributaries that contribute to it unfettered right now. You run into another issue, which is the family farmers are generations old up there, and they're family farmers. They're not corporate farmers. They'll all go away without water. They won't have any way to make a living. If you want to see that happen and support those environmental groups that claim that we're causing harm to the environment, we also have the dam removal project that seems to be ongoing. And, you take the dams out of the Klamath River currently, there's all kinds of claims. They've made budgets for that, but they're pretty unrealistic from what I've read. There's a lot of conflicts in how much it's going to cost and how much sediment's actually going to get washed down the river and how many years it's going to take to wash into the ocean. And that very sediment is what they're claiming hampers the spawning and success of, the salmon.
Sure, but throwing 20 million cubic yards of sediment into the river and expecting it to wash down 190 miles. I mean, I don't think people realize sometimes how far that is. It's 190 miles of river.
And it's often not, we don't often have flood stage waters to help either. The other thing is, the dams come out, the natural flows are reinstituted, and Klamath Lake's dries up. There won't be any water coming out of Klamath Lake. And there won't be any water running into the Klamath River from there.
Yeah, Klamath River goes dry, right?
Historically, nobody wants to admit that for some reason.
Yeah, so you got that to look at.
It's mystery
history. Have the fact that during floods, those towns and houses and stuff downriver are going to be in harm's way sometimes, which they are not right now. Although none of the dams were built for flood control, I have to agree with that. That was the purpose, was to generate electricity. Little tidbit, too, I'd like to throw out there. My grandfather was a World War I veteran. He joined when he was 16, and he went to France and fought there. And in his telling of the story of the project development, the project had all the water rights. The growers had all the water rights. They were given to each individual homesteader, veteran homesteader, by the President of the United States himself. They willingly gave up some of their water rights to promote the development of those dams to generate electricity to support the project. In return, they got a guarantee of power, and they agreed to provide power for 50 years to the project irrigators, at a retail value when they signed the agreement. So in beginning, these were put into place to support the project to start with. And I just think my grandfather would be having a heart attack right now if he saw all the claims and all the changes that have occurred in the operation of that project. It's unfortunate. That's typical, I guess, when you start considering how things evolve over time and conflicting interests come to bear.
Oh, yeah, conflicting interests, and people forget what the original purpose was.
But you have, in this, I think the most frustrating part of this whole thing is the big conflicts are really created with revisionist history and magical science. I mean, this isn't actual science is creating a conflict. This is fiction that's creating conflict. You know, the idea that because the dam removal people will constantly tell you that by taking out the dams, they're going to have more water and more fish.
Right.
Okay. Well, you're going to take out a hatchery. Oh, they think they're going to keep the hatchery. There won't be any water to run the hatchery, but they're going to keep the hatchery. So those 6 million fish, boom, they're gone. But they're going to have more fish by taking out the 6 million that they're putting in the system.
But the river's going to go dry if there's no dams.
Right. But then you got to go to the other magical pieces of history because, you know, the coho salmon are endangered, but I can buy them at Costco. But they're different somehow, and nobody seems to be able to give me an adequate explanation to that, mostly because I refuse to hear it. I'm brutal that way. But, you know, all of this is just, and I'm going to say self-inflicted, but it's obviously not the farmers doing it. This is government and special interests that have just gone berserk. And for some reason, they're laser focused on this one place.
Can't argue with that. Definitely agree with that.
It's nuts. And so when people, you know, when you start telling people about this, they go, well, I don't get it. You're like, well, don't get all worked up. It's going to get, you know,
it's going to get crazier.
It makes less sense. As the farther you dig into it, the nuttier it becomes. We're going to have to do tons more shows, obviously, on the Klamath to keep people up to speed. But I really do hope people that aren't haven't already signed up with a team on one side or the other. I really hope you'll do some homework and look at actual facts. And if it makes no sense, it might actually be fiction. So anyway, thanks a million, Jim. And we again burned through 2 more hours. Did you think it would go this fast?
No, absolutely not.
I know. It's lots of fun. Fun for everyone.
Thank you very much, Jim, for coming on.
Thanks a million. So Jim Smith is the Ag Commissioner up in Siskiyou County. It's a place with lots of issues and problems that we talk about a lot because it's coming for you someplace else. So tune in next week, WeThePeopleRadio.us.